first 10-minute speaker is Ralph C.
My name is Ralph. I'm an alcoholic. Kind of caught me off guard because I didn't hear the 12 traditions, or maybe I was sleeping. I'm not sure. For me, there's three basic requirements or musts that I have in my sobriety, and one is my sobriety date. That's November 16th, 1990. And through the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had to have a drink or a drug since that date. And for that, I am truly grateful. And the other thing is I have a home group. It's the Auburn Fellowship of Auburn, California. And the third thing is I have a sponsor, and my sponsor has a sponsor. My sponsor has 19 years of sobriety, and his sponsor has over 30 years of sobriety. You know, and that's what works for me, you know. Alcoholics Anonymous has really changed my life. You know, I was one of them people that came around. I went to a recovery home, got sober. And I remembered I just wanted to get my first wife back and my little girl. That's all I wanted. And lo and behold, when I picked up my six-month chip, they were back in my life. And when I picked up my ninth-month chip, they were leaving for the final and last time. And what had happened to me is because I didn't put my sobriety first, I lost my sobriety. So when I slithered back into Alcoholics Anonymous, November 16th, 1990, I was ready. I got sober this time for me, to save my life, and it's been working for me. You know, the program works real good for me when I work it. When I don't, you know, happiness is a byproduct of the kind of life I live. And when I choose to practice the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life, things go pretty well. You know, so what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me is they took a human being without principles and they put some principles in my life. You know, and it's hard for me to put into words how much my life has changed in 8 years. But one thing I would like to say that it really wasn't revealed to me, but it was when I picked up my eighth-year chip that I had been sober longer now than I drank or used drugs. I was like, that was an overwhelming thing for me. You know, and I got a lot of gratitude in my heart for Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, this past summer I was up working in Oregon and I got to go fly fishing with Charlie. And we had the whole lake to ourselves. And it's just things like that that are just amazing. You know, I'm employable. I've had the best year I've ever had. You know, and it just shows under our Christmas tree. As a matter of fact, we were able to buy a home this year. And the kind of alcoholic I was, that wasn't possible before. So, you know, I had a bunch of things I wanted to come up here and a bunch of real good things I wanted to come up here and tell you. And like I told Linda, I said I could never be a 30-minute speaker because it's just like I got all these good ideas and then when I come up here, it's like, you know, all I can say is one thing I would like to share with you, this one little story, is when I was a youngster, I was always afraid of dying. I mean, every time we'd go by, like, the mortuary or whatever, I'd kind of hunker down in the back seat. Well, this last year, on February 11th, my father died. And there was a little bit of story I want to tell you that leads up to it. This is the power of Alcoholics Anonymous working in my life. So what happened was my dad was dying of emphysema. So as most of you know, this is a long, prolonged deal. And I began to share with my father towards the end. I told him I had this dream. And I asked God why he didn't take my father. And he said that he wasn't ready yet. So because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had the courage to go to my father and I started sharing some things off my four-step to my father. And he was kind of gazing out the window. And as I started sharing some of my real personal stuff that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, that I didn't want nobody to know. I shared with him some real personal things, and I grabbed my father's attention. And he turned to me, and he looked at me. And I had to go to work in San Francisco, and I called home 2 days later. My mom said that he called for the priest for final absolution. And in less than 36 hours, my father was dead. And I was there, and I watched him take his last breath. And just for God to allow me to be some small part of that is just one of the gifts Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. Thank you.
Thank you, Ralph. Our second 10-minute speaker is Kathy L.
Well, this seems to be... my name is Kathy L., and I'm an alcoholic. This was a surprise tonight. I didn't expect a chair, or let alone stand up here in front of a speaker and chair. Last night I had a last-minute one also. But anyways, you know, it's 1999 coming up, and I'll be having two birthdays. I'll be having my biological, my belly button birthday and my sobriety birthday in February. And I'll be 3 years, God, you know, willing that I make it that long. And and thinking back, I remember when I was about 18 and almost practically all my life, I didn't think I was going to make it to 20 years old because of the depression I had and the desire to die, because I always wanted to die. And so that was pretty much it. Anyways, I have a lot of gifts today in my life. I have a mom and dad that I'm grateful for. My dad and I never got along as we were growing up because, well, he was the alcoholic, you know, and he would, you know, drink. And the kind of alcoholic he was, he'd drink and pass out on the couch. But that's just part of my story that I share because I had a lot of bitter animosity towards him, and I always resented him. And very functional alcoholic. And then today, though, I have a relationship with him, and I'm very grateful he's in my life. And there's a lot of people losing the people that they love. So, anyways, I have a 4-year-old daughter, and today it's wonderful because I get to participate in her preschool, which is something I don't think I would have been able to do, you know, had I continued on the same path. I tried getting sober by myself, not using the program, and I managed to stay sober for about 3 years. So this is why I get a little nervous. It's 3 years coming up in February. And so I met my husband at a church, because I thought church might help me, you know, continuing on the sobriety. So I was in a Catholic church, and we got married. Well, I got pregnant before I got married, right? So then we bought a house, and just all this stuff was going on, and I was so insane inside. I was just like on the outside. I didn't look like I was, but I worked very hard, you know, trying to keep up, you know, looking good and just going to work. And finally, and it was like shortly after, about a month after 3 years, and I vaguely have an idea of when I exactly stopped drinking. All I know is that we had a fight, because we had fought a lot. And I found some brandy in the garage, and I drank it, and I was back there. You know, I stopped drinking alcohol because of this depression, and, you know, there I was. You know, after I had stopped all this time and this insanity, I just, like... I picked up the bottle, and that warmth was there. He took off. You know, he left somewhere. And then when he came back, and I had drank in half the bottle, things were fine. I mean, I forgot what we were fighting about, and I had the warmth in my stomach. Oh, honey, you know, don't you know it's okay? But that's just part of my story in the end stages, because I was at the later. I went from here to here in 3 months. So I lost, we had been fighting and he turned violent, and there was, along with verbal abuse and constant degrading, you know, we finally split up, and that was good that we split up, and but before that I lost my job, and that made him even more upset at me. I lost my job because I took booze to the office, because eventually, you know, what happened to me after I took that first drink was I couldn't get out of bed without having a drink, and the problem was hiding it from him, and he was real good. It was like a cat and mouse game. He just loved to find my bottles, which was a bummer, you know, and I really had to be creative. It was a bummer, and I remember that was part of the insanity, and I just thought, well, God, you know, and after 3 months, eventually, I could barely even get a buzz off of hard liquor, you know, and that's just beer bottles, forget it. I had no time for beer. I had to go straight out of the bottle. I had to get, or it wasn't even in bottle. It was hairspray bottles, you know. It was just really, so I did lose my job, and then that just catapulted us even worse, and we eventually divorced. And then I did manage to get some sobriety, and I got sober at Kaiser. My mom took me there in a blackout, and I managed to stay sober. My ex-husband, I filed divorce papers. I said, it's not going to work after all this counseling that we had been through. And it's either going to work or it's not going to work, you know, with anything. I just come to the conclusion these counselors are making so much money. And you're either going to work on it or you're not. So he was working on me. And he didn't drink. He didn't drink. I took his pain pills and stuff like that. He wasn't even into his pain pills because he had a lower back problem. And so he found out and he locked him in this metal box. It was so funny. But anyways, it was just, I stayed sober through my husband taking my daughter away when she was about 2 years old. I stayed sober through that, and it's like I had to call my sponsor every day. I had to really, you know, get in and work the steps. You know, I had to just dive in, and it was, I heard the expression where, you know, you're in the boxing ring, and you're bloody, you know, from your every orifice, you know, you're just bloody. And you're on the other side of the ring, and they're pushing you out, you know, go in, you know, come on, get up and fight. You know, and I was just lit because I wanted just to either kill him or I wanted to kill myself. And I was just, it was a really hard time. But I managed. And today it's like after almost 3 years of sobriety, I can, you know, I did a lot of hideous things. I drove drunk with her in the car. You know, there's a lot of yets. I never have been in jail. I've never got a DUI. As a matter of fact, I got this thing in the mail for my good driving record, a 5-year renewal, you know. But what really was coming to me, if they had known, you know, I wouldn't have any license at all because, you know, of all the things I thought about, you know, what I did. And I just so happened to get away with it, you know. And so, I mean, there's a lot of things, but the main thing is I want to say, is I can't believe the time it took me, just 3 months, you know, and I was down here. And the next step was the street, by the way, because funds ran out, okay? And I was just, you know, willing, you know, just to do anything to get that buzz, you know. And I reached my bottom with alcohol. And I'm fortunate for that because, you know, drugs was next. You know, it was just downhill. So, I have a great job. I have a great job. I've got, I was there a year. It's December marks my year there at my job. I've had a great performance record. I've got a bonus and a free massage. A free massage, you know, at one of these places, a gift certificate to have a massage. And I mean, that's just, you know, that didn't, you know, I was always being reprimanded or fired or, you know, and this is just actually, you know, one of those, you know, blessings in life. And, you know, it can be gone tomorrow. it can gone, be gone tomorrow. So today I'm grateful for everything that I have today, and just anything, small things. And I'm especially glad for my mom and dad for being there, for, you know, they're supporting me. And my dad, he's an alcoholic. He's still drinking. My mom doesn't drink, but she's a Christian lady. And I hope that my dad, I know he sees what I'm all that I'm doing, because he knows me when I was down, you know, when I was getting bad. And my dad was maintenance alcoholic, and he was a functional one, and I was not functional. So I hope that maybe I can not a role model, but something that he can see where I'm going. And today I'm just working the best I can with my sponsor on my steps, and trying to stay out of the malls. But just really, today is great. And I do have my ups and downs. Today, or this week, was kind of a down week. I don't know, just one of those less than feeling weeks. And this is the second meeting that I've come to, and I've volunteered to chair a meeting, or to help chair a meeting, and I feel so much better. I mean, this is, someone told me that I was going to be standing at a speaker and talking, I mean, I just would have laughed, because, you know, I just took the F in class, you know, I didn't, let alone stand in front of the classroom and talk, I just took the F, you know. So go ahead, you know, I think that's about all I have to say. And thank you.
Speaker tonight is Gloria S.
Hi, everybody. I'm Gloria Santos, and I'm an alcoholic. Merry Christmas, and welcome especially to Christopher. I always get nervous. I'm the kind of person that when I got sober, I saw microphones in these rooms, and I would not ever go back to that meeting. I'd see a podium, and I wouldn't go back. But somewhere along the way, I realized that it was just my own fear, that I'm a member of AA, just as we all are a member. And I was reading something last night, and it was talking, this lady was asking this fellow about her purpose in life. She wanted to get a handle on it. She wanted to understand it. And he says, well, you're part of the story tree. She didn't understand, so she thought all kinds of stuff. And then she finally had to ask somebody else, what did that mean, story tree? And he says, well, each leaf on the tree is a story. And she originally thought that that meant that she was supposed to write some fictional story, and I read a lot of nonfiction stuff. Well, this lady, it was explained to her that that leaf represents her story, her life. And I guess that's what we do, is we share our experience, strength, and hope, and what I share is my story. And when I first started coming to meetings, I thought if I could just get to a point where I could talk about it, what happened, what it was like, then I wouldn't have to do it any longer. I thought that was kind of a magical thing, that once you got to say it in public, you know, then you wouldn't ever have to bring it up again. And I did not understand at all. I really thought that if I did the steps the one time, that I wouldn't have to do them again. I really thought that I would be cured of whatever it is, alcoholism is, and I wouldn't have to participate any longer. I never was one that kind of belonged to groups. I've always kind of avoided it. I've been more of a loner. And the two times I was in AA before, I did not do what was suggested, and I definitely avoided the steps. I figured I could read them off the wall, I could read them in the book, and that's all it was about it, that it was an intellectual thing. I did not conceive, I just could not see, we were talking about a way of life. My understanding of who I was totally different than the reality. And I had a... what I am going to tell you is about today and yesterday. Real interesting days. The last time I drank was in June of 1986. Thank you. So I've been sober 12 and a half years today, or yesterday, I guess. And I don't really know which day of the month I stopped drinking. I knew I was about a year sober, and I kind of looked back, and I couldn't remember, so I chose 2-2 just because it was a good number, and I knew it was a safe number because I had stopped drinking somewhere in the middle of the month. So I've always celebrated my birthday on June 22nd. And I got a blast from the past yesterday with a phone call. And to kind of give you the way it was and kind of keep it real short for 3 or 4 minutes here, I didn't drink when I was a teenager. My folks did. I was raised in an alcoholic home, and there was a lot of stuff that's, you know, around that. I started drinking when I was 18. I was about 2 weeks after I graduated from high school. My oldest brother, who was everything to me, my big brother, my friend, he died drunk driving. And he had been in the Navy out here in California. I had been drinking, real, you know, partying, going to work, but still partying. And we got a call, and my brother had died. And what that did for me is I was planning on going to college anyway, but I'd go over to friends' houses, and although I was not legally of age to drink, they'd give me a highball. And what happened was I loved the effect of alcohol. And I was sober for years before I actually went home and started asking myself, what does that mean to me personally? The effect, it says in the big book, it says in the doctor's opinion, you know, it's the effect that alcohol has on me. And I really had to sit and think about it. What did it do for me? It made the pain go away of my brother dying. I didn't have to think about it. I was always kind of a scaredy cat. I had a lot of fear, and I wouldn't do things. I wouldn't put myself out. If I thought I was going to fail something, I wouldn't try. And when I started drinking, right away, I was in college. I drank with other heavy drinkers, but I also worked full-time, and I went to college. And we all drank heavy when we drank. But I had blackouts right away. And I passed out in the bars right away. And I didn't have that long string of time being a social drinker and then creating problems. The problems I had the first 3 years of my drinking were kind of internal, that shame that I was doing things that I knew I shouldn't, that I felt bad about. There was a lot of fear. The day afters, I wouldn't want to talk about the night we had drank. I had a hit and run that my mother told me about, and I didn't remember it. And, of course, I did not go back and try and make things right. What I did was I moved from Massachusetts to California. And so I drank real heavy right from the very beginning, and then I stopped for a number of years. And then in 1985, the last five years of my drinking, it was real so much like Kathy said, the progression of the disease really took over my life. Within a couple of years, I started drinking again, I think, around 76. And within a couple of years, I could no longer hold a job. And I had been a professional, middle-class, you know, person in my 20s. I hadn't drank, and then I started drinking just on weekends. And then it was kind of like Friday through Sunday night. And then I moved away, and I lost that job, so I started drinking daytime. Those last 5 years, I just stopped working. And I gave up all those things that were important to me, my home. I gave up custody of my son. And in my mind, I rationalized it, you know, that was the thing to do because his dad had a job and I didn't. And he was a boy. He needed to be with his dad during it. I had every excuse in the world. And for years and years when I drank, I cried. And what the big book has taught me about that is that that's because I was so full of self-pity. The world was doing me, my brother died, don't you know? And somebody in the program pointed out to me, it was like, Gloria, it was your brother that died. But see, I only thought about myself. And I remember times when I drank and I'd come home, I was 18 or 19, and my mother would be just really having a fit with me. And I was thinking about that earlier today because I had drove in order to get home, and I was in a blackout when I got there, and the lady's having a fit, and I remember being mad with her because she was angry with me. And she had already lost one child. And here I was drinking and driving. And so I couldn't put those things in perspective because my whole world revolved around me and my feelings and what I thought things should be. So in 1985, October of 85, I got arrested for my fourth DUI. And the ones previous, I got probation on one, I think. And I think I might have done a few days in jail. The last 5 years of my drinking, I started getting arrested. And I never got caught on that early stuff. I didn't start getting in trouble with the law until I was in my late 20s and my early 30s. And not only driving, but I had a big mouth. I drank, and that self-pity had turned to anger. And I was a very angry woman for a long time. And I remember breaking things and putting holes in the walls and really causing a lot of problems in my own. I caused those problems. And what's important to me in sobriety is to remember that I am responsible for all of it. And folks have said to me that, oh, Gloria, you were in a blackout. And it's kind of like that really doesn't, that's not an excuse. And the fact that I did not intend to kill somebody does not take away the fact that I did kill somebody. In my fourth DUI, I was drinking straight vodka by 11 o'clock in the morning. And I was in a blackout by 1. And I was over near Cal Expo, and I hit a man. And he was a young man. He was 22, somebody I did not know. He was married, had a little boy. And I was arrested on the scene. I am very grateful today that I did not leave. I was in a blackout. I do not take any credit for any of that. For whatever reason, I stayed in the car. And I came to from the blackout in the sheriff's office. And it wasn't the first time coming to from a blackout, but it was the first time that I had a sheriff yelling at me, that I know what I had done and I did not know. Years later, after I had gotten sober, one of the things that I did was, it took the man 3 days to die. And that pained me because I could see, I would have visions of his family over at the med center in his room praying that this man would survive. And he didn't. What happened was I bailed out and I drank even worse. And to me, at 12 and a half years sober, when I look back at that stuff, I realized the insanity of that. Even when I was 18, if somebody was not an alcoholic and their family member died from drinking and driving, they would swear off alcohol. They'd never pick it up. I went toward it. I sought it out. The same thing after I killed that fellow. If I could have controlled it, I had every reason in the world not to drink at all. And what I did was I drank more. And I tried not to drink for a couple of weeks, but it was, I couldn't emotionally handle it at all to begin with. And by this time, I had just about no friends, and I'd been alienated from my family for quite a while. So I was on bail for 8 months. I had been in AA before, and the pride, I didn't want to be an alcoholic. That was a dirty word. I had gone to meetings, and all you guys sat around and laughed and talked to each other, and I did not feel I belonged. I had no intention at all of sharing my personal life with you strangers. I was raised in the kind of family where you didn't bring your troubles outside the family. And unfortunately, we didn't bring our problems to the family members either. We just didn't talk about stuff at all. And in the spring of 86, I had this college degree, right? And I was actually enrolled in a master's program when I killed this fella. And I had done all right for a couple of years because I was only drinking on school breaks. And then I got to where I was drinking. I couldn't get past the first exam. So for like 3 semesters in a row, I kept withdrawing and withdrawing. And so I was a graduate student when I ended up killing this fella. And that spring, I ended up homeless. Fishes and loaves, all the charity stuff. And I remember the humiliation of doing that because, that just wasn't, it wasn't the way I was raised. I was raised to go to work and take care of yourself. And I always thought I was responsible as long as I could hold a job and pay my bills. But that had nothing to do with emotional responsibility. That I didn't know a clue, I didn't have a clue about. But what happened was, and I wanted to share this because I was thinking about it the other day, we talk about Eskimos, people come into our lives for a split second, and then they're gone. And I sincerely believe today that God, or I had these angels with me. Because, see, I didn't believe in God by this time. I was raised in a religion. When my brother died, I went atheist overnight. And it was the ultimate mad, the ultimate resentment. How could God do this to me? He doesn't exist. That's it, And then those last five years, I was on this search. I just figured the answer was out there somewhere. People were happy, but I wasn't. So obviously, if I could just find the person to tell me, how to be happy or read the right book or get involved with the right philosophy, I'm a real big head person. I like to intellectualize, and I like to play with philosophy in my mind. And I'm a thinker. And so I was kind of agnostic, I guess, in my last 5 years. And when it was really funny, I had gone to AA for a few months, and people would talk about God, and the first thing I wanted to do was run out the door. You know, that's just not me. You folks, you know, that's fine. Weak people need that. I don't need that. Like I said, I had a lot of arrogance. I had a lot of pride. I thought I should know better. People for years would tell me, don't you know better, Gloria? And I really felt that I should have. I did not have a conception that this alcoholism is actually a disease. Anyway, in 86, I was homeless downtown, and I was in this woman's shelter for a couple of weeks. And someone was telling me about how you go down to the welfare office and you get some money, right? And it was the month of January, and I was sitting on this bench on L Street. And this lady was sitting with me, and we were just sitting there, and it was raining and just foggy. And I was telling her I was going to go down to the, wherever it is, Orange 29th. And I didn't have any, I had shoes or sneakers or something, and they were totally wet. And this lady who I did not know, I don't even think she said a whole sentence to me. She took off her boots, and she insisted that I take her boots. Those boots, I walked down to the welfare office. In turn, I was able to get a room in the Del Paso Hotel, which is no longer there, on the corner of Del Paso Boulevard and El Camino. It was a single room upstairs, and I believe now there's law offices or something in that building. But what happened for me was, I believe this lady was put in my life in order to get me over to the Del Paso Boulevard. Because from there, I was directed to a man who had just gotten out of prison. And he would never tell me about prison. All he kept telling me about was AA. There's an AA group down there near the Bank of America. And it's like, I didn't want to hear that. You know, I didn't think that drinking, it was everything else, right? Even as bad as it got. Because I used to always try to figure out how to get out of stuff. If I just wasn't caught, you know, then I didn't have to be honest. And as long as nobody was looking, and what were the odds of getting away with stuff, you know? And hiding my booze in those little spice jars. Yeah, I used to have a terrible problem in Citrus Heights trying to find places to throw the empties, because my ex-husband also used to go through the trash. And anyway, I got over to Del Paso, and this ex-convict 12-stepped me, in essence. And what I remember is I passed him one day going down the boulevard, and he was almost floating. He had blue eyes, and they were real bright, and he was smiling, and he was glowing. And he told me he had just come from a meeting. And see, his words didn't get in, but the picture did get in, because I saw him within a couple of weeks, and he had gone back out. And I met him, I didn't meet him, but I used to be a night person. I was out there at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning in the alleys doing whatever I was doing, and looking for the excitement, I guess, or something. But I saw this fella after he had left AA, and the difference, the picture of with AA and the picture without, was dramatic. And see, I couldn't see it in myself, but I saw it in somebody else. And February 14th, Valentine's Day, I woke up from another drunk, lonelier than I have ever been in my life. And it was that soul sickness we talk about. And I couldn't even stand up at this point physically. I was detoxing so bad. So 3 days later, without drinking, I made it down to the North Sac group. I was sober for about 90 days. And I'm also real grateful that I didn't fight the court. You know, I pleaded guilty right from the very beginning, so I didn't have a trial. It was just a matter of going through the paperwork and showing up when I was supposed to. And I'd take the bus downtown, and I couldn't remember my name. And I used to have the blue card with the Serenity Prayer on it. And I kept reading it. You know, I could read the letters. I didn't have a concept of what it was saying, and I didn't get too into that I was actually praying. I just kept reading off this little card, and I was able to show up. And years later, what I thought I was doing was asking God to help me accept, but what he actually did was he gave me the courage to change. I showed up. You know, I didn't run away from it. And I pleaded guilty in May, and I was 2 weeks sober July 1st, and I was sentenced to 4 years in prison. So I did go to prison. Somebody told me that if I had enough faith, that I wouldn't have to go to prison. And this lady had a lot of years sobriety. And see, I was so afraid. I was petrified of going. I'd never been to prison, been in jail, but never been to prison. And I actually believed everything that I heard in AA. And years later, I thought a lot about that, because within a couple of days after I was sentenced, the same judge sentenced somebody else to 18 months probation for the same offense. And I took that piece of information and I put it in the back closet and I shut the door because I knew I couldn't look at it while I was doing time. I did 25 months. I did not drink. What I believe today is that God doesn't take away the fear when I ask Him. What He does is He gives me the strength to walk through what I need to either stay sober, to get up here in front of you guys, you know, to pay my bills, whatever it is I need to do to grow and to be a decent member of society and a member of the fellowship. I have a little prayer, and I really like it, and it says that God either gives me the strength, He takes away the problem, or else he solves the problem Himself, and it kind of covers all bases for me. When I was in prison, I started praying, and that was pretty good for somebody who was an agnostic, and I didn't know how to, so I used other people's prayers, and I would try and understand what that prayer was talking about from my heart. And I had done step four when I was 2 weeks sober. I sat down and I wrote it, because I hadn't intellectually 1, 2, 3 just sit down and do it, right? And I couldn't, before the times I was in AA, I couldn't sit and write. And someone told me it's because I'd make it real if I put it on paper. So when I was 2 weeks sober this last time, I sat down and I did a four-step, 39, 8 pages, something. And so for 2 years of sobriety, I went 1 through 4. 1 through 4, 1 through 4. I was a very angry person. And I don't have any regrets about that. What I've done since then, I've gone to H9, one of the women's prison, and I've met a lot of ladies that I did time with. And they all came up to me, and they were scared at first because all they could remember was my anger when we were in prison together. And it helped me see the difference between early sobriety and today. So I got out of prison, and I made a commitment to finish the steps, and then I was going to leave, or I was going to commit suicide. I had nothing in Sacramento. I had no family, no friends, no job, no place to live. I was going to go to Mexico. What I did instead was I came back to Sacramento. I started making those financial amends. I went back to school. I finished my master's. One day at a time. I think for the first 6 years I was out of prison, I was in meetings every single day. I've gone through the steps. I can't tell you how many times. It just seems like the more I delved into it, when in sobriety you walk a little bit further down in your life and then something else comes up. And by this time I had faith in AA, I had faith in a higher power, I've had a number of experiences. There's no way that the ability to walk through those have come from me, and I realized that. So my brother dies when I'm 18. I killed this fella in 85. They both had the same first last names. The beginning of my drinking, the end of my drinking. In 1991, I was 5 years sober. Department of Motor Vehicles said I could have my license back. They had to revoke me for 5 years. The black and white honesty for me was, while I did not have a legal license, I did not drive. My first 5 years of sobriety, while in prison, didn't have to worry about it. They took me everywhere, right? But those 3 years afterwards, I did not drive. I walked, I took the bus, I took the bike. I had too much pride to ask people for help. So I did a lot of stuff the hard way. That's been part of one of my defects of character, as far as being a little too independent. So at 5 years, I went back to the DMV, and it was like, do I want to drive? I really didn't. But again, it was a big milestone. And I felt if I was supposed to, then I needed to face it. And so I got my license. I had to go to the driver safety board, and that was interesting. But I had my birthday chip in my pocket. And the lady's sitting there interviewing me, and she's tape recording it. And she finally says something to me about, don't you people celebrate your birthdays, or don't you have medallions or some kind of... So I had to write my pocket, and I had to pull it right out. Because she was asking me all these questions, about AA. And because I'd been going, I could answer her. It was nice being able to be honest. It was great being able to be honest. And I had my license for a couple of weeks, and I didn't want the car. I didn't want to go out and buy a car. It was too big. If it broke down, I couldn't move it myself, right? I had 1,000 reasons why. But I got the fear built up until I actually got on the bus and went down Florin Road And I won't even tell you who it was that sold me the car, but actually I was going to start on one side of Florin Road and walk to the other until I had a car. Within a week, and this is part of who I am, within a week I decided to drive to North Carolina by myself. So I haven't driven for 6-7 years, and I got this four-door car. I never in my life had a four-door. So I tell my boss, can I take time? So I'm driving, and it was July 4th weekend, and I'm outside of Albuquerque, and I hadn't slept a whole lot because I was just going to drive. you know, probably see the Atlantic Ocean and beyond. What happened was it was bright, sunny afternoon outside, about 100 miles outside of Albuquerque, and this lady zoomed up past me, and there was traffic, and she was all over the road. And I thought for sure, oh, boy, am I grateful I'm sober. This lady's drunk, right? And I was keeping my distance. Well, what happened was she had an accident in front of me. And she wasn't drinking. She was about this tall. She was shorter than I, and the dashboard was too high, and I don't believe she could see the road, the lines in the road. And it was tragic, though, because the right side of her car came off with the side guard, and her car picked up in the air and came down on the freeway 90 degrees in front of me. Because I was sober, I had the distance to stop. Because I was sober, I was able to run back and stop traffic. Because I was sober, I was able to hold this woman in my arms while her husband died. And what I kept saying to her was, it's going to be all right. And I kept thinking about people in AA, you know, because I felt a little stupid. You know, all I could do was hold her. And I had no words. All I had was my arms to hold her. And later on, I realized that's what people in AA did for me. And God put me in Albuquerque in order to be there for this woman. I sincerely believe that today. A couple of weeks ago, I was chairing a meeting here in town. And it doesn't often happen this way, but there was a couple of folks in the group who shared. When I share, I try to go off the names like I don't know folks. I mean, I don't always call them my friends. I just go right off the list. And there was two people in this meeting who had family members who were victims of drunk drivers. And these two folks, their loved ones did not die, but they were living with the consequences of drunk driving. And again, I really believe, because I've cried and I've asked God to help me heal, that when that meeting was over, I was able to go up to this woman and I asked her, could I give her a hug? She was very angry and she was very hurt, and we were both crying, and we were able to hug each other. And, you know, these things come to me in sobriety, and I stand back and it's like, wow. My heart was so hard when I got here. And what I feel today is that I needed to go through those steps, open up that heart, my heart, to the pain, the anger, all the fear, so that I could heal and get to the other side where I can show compassion to others, where I can be kind, where I can show that soft heart sometimes and be of service. And I got this phone call yesterday. Oh, actually, I called. I bought a house in 94, and I'm still single, and I never thought that was a possibility. I was the old ideas of where I was raised is women, you don't stay single, and you don't get out there and be successful in society. Well, I am. I have a very good profession. I have a very good job. And I bought a house in 94, and I decided to refinance. So I was supposed to go over there yesterday to sign the papers. And it was such a great feeling, because I did all those financial amends and all that stuff was taken care of, you know, years ago. And I call them up to find out how much cash I needed to bring with me to close the deal. And the lady says, she says, you've got a lien against your house. And it was, what? And she says, well, were you known as Gloria? And she gives my marriage name. See, when I went to prison, I was divorced before I went, but I had my ex-husband's name. And when I got off parole, it was like, ah, I did time in his name. Now I'm going to go back to my maiden name. This is going to be my name. So Gloria Santos is my birth name, my maiden name. And this lady brings up my ex-husband's name, and it's like, uh-oh. What? And then she says, there's something from January of 1986. And it's like, oh, my God, what now? I didn't have enough time to go home and pull out papers, so I went right to her office. And apparently it was the county. And as soon as she said Sacramento County, it was like, I know what that's about. I paid them back. But I didn't have the paperwork. But this is an example of what my life was like. In September of 85, I was collecting AFTC. I had given up custody of my son. I had an extra check. I should have returned it. I needed it. I was drinking. I cashed it. And they told me then I'd have to pay him back. It's like, okay, I don't care. You know, tomorrow was inconceivable to me anyway. So sure, as long as I can cash the check today, that's all I cared about. And then in the spring, I was collecting general assistance. And again, I didn't care that I'd have to pay him back. It wasn't important, but they sent me a promissory note when I was in prison, and I signed it. So I was out of prison within a couple of weeks, and I went down to their office, and they give you $200 to start your life over, gate money. I used $40 of that $200 to start paying them back. And then I was able to get a job within a week or two. So I was able to make payments. Well, I never got a final statement to say it's all done and over with. And well, anyway, they put a lien on my house. And it's just been crazy. I would call up the county today, yesterday, and I wasn't worried. It was like when I was on parole. I was 29 months sober. I had been out of prison for 5 months. I was clean and sober, and I knew it. And the parole agent said I gave him a dirty test. I was being tested every month for alcohol. And I went crazy for 3 weeks because I thought they were going to pull me back in. And see, I was in the right this time. I was so, I can't even think of the word. It was like pointing the finger at somebody else one more time. How can you do this to me? I'm innocent. Well, the truth is the man I killed was totally innocent also. And there used to be a fella in North Sac used to say all the time, oh, just for years I heard him, every time he spoke, he says, I never ever pray for justice. I always pray for mercy. And when I think back of all the things I did when I was drinking that I did not have to pay a price on, or seemingly, except for the emotional, there's all kinds of stuff I should still probably be doing time for that I did not get caught. And here I am one more time, you know, trying to stand there and be the righteous. That's in the 12 and 12 too, I believe, self-righteousness. But it was really nice because today and yesterday I talked to these people in the county, I talked to people in the title company, and I was able to be respectful. I was able to be nice. I didn't have to be demanding because, see, my life's okay right now. If this didn't go through, it's like, okay. They told me they couldn't respond within 7 days. The title companies say we've got to finish this within 3. And it's like, okay. You know, I did the step work. And that's what AA has taught me. Then I leave the results up to God. As long as I try, then I'm okay with me. And it isn't about succeeding at everything I try. It's not about the goal. It's about how I can keep my conscience clear and say that perhaps I am trying sincerely to do God's will. Someone sent me a couple of paragraphs out of a book, and I went through a period in sobriety where it was step 3, God's will. If I just knew exactly what he wanted me to do, I'd do it. But it's not that easy or clear or black and white. I would agonize over some of this stuff. And what I finally ended up concluding was God doesn't care if I wear green socks or red socks, as long as I get dressed. You know, well, in this little paragraph, what it says is, what pleases God is my desire to do his will. Not that I know what his will is for me, but if I sincerely desire to do that, then that is what pleases God. And that kind of takes that craziness out of wanting to do things right and being perfect and not failing. And it's like, all I need to do is try and keep my side of the house clean. And the beautiful thing about the 12 steps is when I do things that are human, we're talking about steps 6 and 7, I got steps 8 and 9 right after it. And I can make amends on a daily basis if need be. And what was so nice was this morning, the county called me, which I didn't really expect. I figured I was on Christmas vacation. Talked to the lady. She blames the other one blames them, and whatever. So this other lady called me at noon. She says, we're done. They sent the form. and you can pick up a copy of it. So after work, I went over and I gave her a Christmas card, and I was just so grateful because she took that little extra time to take care of it. And and that's kind of like the way things are right now today. In a meeting the other night, the folks were saying that what AA has given to them is a life they never dreamed that was possible. And I can sincerely say that. When I think about the steps, and I hear a lot of stuff, and especially when I was younger, I used to take everything home and figured that was the gospel truth as far as AA. And people would say, I only do steps 1 through 3, or they've been sober for a while, so they only do 10 through 12. The way it's been for me is someone else explained it really well. And, of course, everything I say is stuff I've heard from other people in AA. But he was talking about the principles behind the steps. And I remember one year in our local central office publication, they listed 1 through 12, and they listed a spiritual principle next to each number. I thought, ah, okay, so I put it on my refrigerator. And I spent a lot of time trying to say, okay, step 3, this is the principle, how did I apply it, and what does it mean, and, you know, trying to understand again. But what this gentleman said this past year, he says that, and I agree with him as far as my story, that the principles are interwoven in within all the steps, and perhaps I learn about perseverance through step 9, but maybe somebody else learned about it through in step 5. And those principles, if I practice them long enough, they do become a way of life. And that's another thing that I really had to learn about was those four-letter word principles, like self-discipline. I didn't have a clue. If I didn't want to do something, I didn't do it, period. Didn't matter if it was good for me or bad for me. If I didn't want to do it, I wouldn't go to work. If I didn't want to do it, I wasn't going to apologize to anybody. But the thing about self-discipline is it doesn't matter how I feel. If I sincerely feel in my heart and in my gut that this is the right thing to do, I need to do it no matter what. And what the beauty is that when I find I do these things, I feel so much better afterwards. The gifts for me come after I put things into action. And there's also a phrase that I really like that I wanted to share. And it's, pray with your feet moving. In other words, the way I look at that is the promises come true for me just to the extent of the effort and the work I put into them. And that's kind of paraphrasing what the big book says. But I thought in my little girl mind that if I just sat here long enough and wished hard enough, if God really loved me, he'd give me what I wanted. I was an adult, and I was still thinking this way. And what I realized today is that I have some dreams and some hopes or whatever. I work toward them. If they're not supposed to be part of my life, I need to accept that and just get on with it. But I sincerely feel that God's will for me is to try to get out there and to do the best I can. And in the meantime, I pray while I keep moving. Because I had a couple of years in sobriety, 3-4 years, and I was up on that mountaintop. People talk about pink clouds. Well, I was living up there for almost 2 years after I finally did those steps for the first time. Nothing could touch me. I was smiling all the time. I was feeling good. I was feeling right with my conscience. I was feeling right with life. And then things kind of went up and down, like Kathy was saying, kind of up and down. And then about 4 or 5 years ago, I got into that spiritual oasis or desert or whatever, where when I prayed, I didn't get that feeling. And what I realized what I needed to do was to keep getting on my knees no matter what. I was in the habit of praying in the morning and the night, so I kept doing it no matter that I didn't get that feeling back. And that lasted for a couple of years. Even going into meetings, it was like I was there because I wanted to stay sober. And I knew that that was the way I needed to stay involved. I volunteered even more with AA as far as some of the service work that I've done. And that dryness has left. And the last 2 years, perhaps, I've been able to feel the joy again. And I've been able to be in touch with the simple things in life and other people. And it's really been quite a journey. I'm very grateful to have been asked to share. And again, I'm one of those introverts. I wouldn't do this for anybody else in the world except for AA. And I thank you all very much. Mm-hmm.